underneath. You leave it on. For the record, this is the registrar's stakeholder group scheduled originally from 10:45 a.m. to 12:15 local time.
Okay, we're going to start up again. We have the SAC here. I think we have to change a recording, do we?
It's done.
Oh, it's done. Okay.
Yeah, we already told them to do that.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead. Go for it.
Thank you very much for inviting SAC to meet you. Sorry. I'm Patrick Feldstrom, chair of SAC, and to my left, I have Jim Galvin, vice chair. Jill.
What did you just say?
He said Jill.
To the left of me, I have Jim Galvin, Vice Chair of SAC. We have provided a couple of slides to you. Next slide, please. And next slide. Let me just mention what SAC actually is. We're an advisory committee of ICANN. We provide guidance to ICANN board, various supporting organizations and advisory committees, and to the general community. We have a charter to advise the ICANN and community and board on matters relating to the security and integrity of the Internet's naming and address allocation systems. We are 39 members appointed by the ICANN board for three-year terms, and we do have a membership committee that Jim Galvin is chair of, to which you can submit an application to be evaluated for membership of SAC. We are working on a large number of issues at the moment, most related to DNS, but also some related to IP addressing, and, of course, the new DTLD program. Next slide, please. We publish approximately six reports each year, and the work parties that where we are doing the work is not always producing a report, and sometimes the conclusion is that no report is needed, but quite often we actually produce reports based on what we are doing. So given that we are short on time, Michaela and myself talked a little bit about what we actually should present, and as you already have some slides about some issues, why not talk about something else? You can come back to all the SAC members and ask about material in this report and others. So let me ask all the SAC members in the room to stand up. Okay. Now you know what we look like. Most of them have one head and such things, yes.
But I'm disappointed to see that one of them doesn't have a hat. What's that about?
So what we will talk about is the do we have this? Is this internal name certificate there? No. If you go back to the list. So on this page you see SAC 57, Advisor on Internal Name Certificates from March 2013. Let me explain a little bit what that is about. Already in 2010, SAC released a report, SAC 45, that talks about various different kind of issues related to what we call namespace collisions. That implies that when new TLDs are allocated, it is not the case, and delegated, it's not the case that that the actual domain names has not been used on the internet. In fact, what we write about in SAC 45 is that a large number of to be delegated TLDs are already in use. We also wrote, so that is what we in SAC call namespace collision, that enterprises and private persons around the world use TLDs and use domain names specifically for internal communication, but when later the TLDs are actually delegated, suddenly you get a conflict in the namespace between the local use of the name and the global use of the name. And as we all know, in DNS, you don't like that. That creates surprises, that creates security implications, that creates all different kind of what in layman terms is called a mess. One of the things that we, one small piece of this namespace collision is something that happens with certificates. Because as you know, with X509 certificates and the way they are used today, someone that has a domain name go to a certificate authority, request a certificate for the domain name that they have. The CA is validating that the certificate, that the domain name actually belongs to whoever requests the certificate, in some cases by sending email to an email address in the domain name, sometimes doing other kind of measures. But they are validating that the domain name belongs to the customer, and then issues the certificate. And the certificate includes as one of the attributes the domain name which it covers. For a domain name that doesn't exist in DNS, of course, that normal validation is not possible because you cannot send email globally to a domain name to that domain name. But certificate authorities that have this practice of issuing these certificates then warn the customer, oh, this you ask for a certificate for domain name that doesn't exist. Do you still want to continue? And at those CAs, you have the ability to continue. So what we found out that we wrote in the report is that there is an ability for people to go to a certificate authority and request a certificate for a domain name in a TLD that is not yet delegated. And what this report is talking about is the implications, security implications, and the risk for, of course, man-in-the-middle attacks that can happen when later the domain name is delegated. Okay. So people will be able to connect to websites and whatever. There are, I think, a couple of hundred RFCs, not only HTTP, that uses X509 and SSL certificates, so it's not only the web. So the end user and the applications will be happy. They think they have a secure connection, but it's in reality it is to whoever has managed to get this certificate before the TLD was delegated. What we did in January 2013 was that we recommended ICANN to create a disclosure policy to mitigate these, to try to work on mitigation strategies for this. ICANN immediately contacted the CA Browser Forum, and they changed their policy to, instead of waiting 3 years after the first contract was signed to revoke certificates and stop with the policy, to instead having an agreement that issuing internal name certificates, which these are called, should happen 90 days after the first signing of the contracts, and after 120 days, the existing such certificates should be revoked. So after that, ESSAC felt that the report itself could be published, and it was then published beginning of March of 2013. If you look in the report itself, you see, first of all, the report, which is the ESSAC view in January when we handed over the report to ICANN, and then in Appendix A, you will see a description of what happened between the report was ready and it was published. So that's a description of the internal name certificate, which is, as I started by saying, is one of the ways you can get namespace collisions. There are others as well, of course, and most of you that know about DNS, I hope, should be a little bit scared over what happened with search path use and similar issues, but that is something that we in ESSAC are looking at, but there is we don't have any report on that specific issue. So namespace collisions we and others have been writing about since many years back, since the beginning of, I think, the first one, among the first ones around 2003 or something. And then internal name certificates is the last one that we wrote, which is from March 2013. So with that, I open up for question on this topic and others.
Questions for those in the room? Anyone? Questions for those on the bridge? sorry, Rob Hall, just to be clear, you're saying that they're still selling these certificates even knowing that an impending collision is coming?
Yes.
And no thought was given to perhaps they should start to warn their clients that if you buy a certificate of that today, we're taking it away potentially in the next year?
I think as this has to do with discussions and agreements within the CA browser forum, that's something which is a discussion that I have not been part of. So I don't have an insight in what kind of communication they are doing internally in their organization. So maybe there is other people in the room that do have better knowledge and can answer that question, but I cannot even answer it.
Okay.
So I don't know.
Would it be fair to say that, as you said, this is a small part of the collisions that may occur in this? The certificate area is a small part of the collisions that may occur, that the other collisions are not nearly as severe or as of concern to the SAC, so the other alternate routes and that type of thing don't pose nearly the same threat. It's really these certificates that are the main problem.
I think it's hard to, you cannot really compare one problem for the other because there are various implications which are significant and very, very serious. Depending on how you're looking, and it also depends, it might be the case that it depends, for example, on what kind of domain name it is, how it is in use, what it's used for, etc. So the implications are different. What has happened, and the reason why I'm a little bit sort of not really responding to your question, so I understand that you're a little bit non-satisfied with the response, is that ICANN has committed a study on namespace collision issues. And that report is very close to be finished, if not already finished. And ICANN staff is the normal process. They are looking at the findings and will do, if I understand correctly, a public comment period on recommendations on mitigations against what was found in that report. The reason why I know a little bit, we know in SAC a little bit about that is because we are asked explicitly by the board to have a look at those conclusions and the various mitigation mechanisms related to those issues, which includes, I hope, various namespace collision issues for various protocols and various whatever, and say whether we think that the findings and mitigations are sound and makes us sleep better at night. But that is work that is currently ongoing.
One more. Sorry. Back to the certificate question. It occurs to me that these people that have bought these certificates from the various certificate authorities are also our clients. Is there any way for us to detect that they've done this and for us to reach out and perhaps warn them and say, look, this is coming, and start to educate them if the certificate authorities are basically sticking their head in the sand and, in fact, still perpetuating the problem? Perhaps we could help. Is there any way that this could be detected or a list could be drawn up and we could reach out to our clients and say, hey, you maybe want to be aware of this?
The problem with both the internal name certificates and also some other namespace collision issues is that the reason why people use domain names which are not TLDs internally is because they have a feeling, and in certain configurations of your internal network, you do it internally, which means that the only thing we can see or you can see globally on the internet is leakage, which basically means that the only thing we see are the misconfigured cases. So, and that's why it's completely impossible to say what actually will happen before a TLD is actually delegated. That's when you start to get matches when lookups are done. So the only thing we can see are the misconfiguration and the leakage, and then we can extrapolate to and guess what the actual use is for, and from that draw conclusions of what kind of risk there is. What you can do are, I think, two things. First of all, I do know that many parties, both registries and registrars that are dealing with domain names, are also dealing with certificates. So that's, of course, a normal one path forward. The other one is simply to include information about namespace collision risks to your respective customers and clients. I think that is something that is very important, because there there, as we've written in our reports, there are various even recommendations from vendors to actually use non-allocated TLDs for enterprises internally that enterprises have followed. So what we are talking about is that many companies and organizations in the world, due to the new DTLD process, must ensure that they are changing everything from their training material to recommended configuration of equipment to maybe even default configuration of equipment must change to not create any namespace collision issues. Regarding specifically the namespace certificates, I wanted to go back to your question. What can really be done is that we have seen with the X509 certificates and the whole idea by having lists of trusted CAs that are shipped around in browsers and operating systems and stuff do have various weaknesses. For example, we have a couple of incidents like DigiNotar when a CA got hacked or made mistakes or in one way or another issued certificates to non-domain name holders. So what we are saying is that the only way of solving this problem is by starting to use technologies like the Dane technology developed by the IETF, where a hash of or fingerprint of the certificate of the domain name holder is actually stored in DNS at the same domain name that the certificate covers, and then that is signed with DNSSEC. That is what we see from ESSEC at the moment. That is the only way for path forward to really make this easier, because we will always have various different kind of weaknesses related to list of CAs. So, but still, I want to point out that the CA and internal certificate issue is one issue that is resolved with Dane. We have other namespace collision issues, and that is something we have to keep our eyes open for.
I'll keep going. I have one more. It seems to me that if we ever get to a second round of TLDs, which I think most of us are hopeful we will, this will occur again, potentially. Has there been any thought, or would it be within the purview of the ESSOC to perhaps recommend the creation of a, for lack of a word, a TLD that's reserved for exactly this type of certificate if there is a need for it internally for companies?
There are already RFCs that talk about top-level domains, and they're also listed in the applicant guidebook that are not to be allocated at TLD, as TLDs ever, like example, local, and a few others. I don't really know them on top of my head, but there are a couple of them, yes. And I think that is just like 192.168.24/16 or 10/8 and those kind of private address space. I think that is... that is exactly the way the path forward, and not sort of use something that can be used in the future.
Jeff?
Thank you. Jeff Beckhouse here. So I do have one question. I believe that maybe it was last week, I can't remember the exact date, the Internet Architecture Board issued a statement about dotless domains, and part of it was they had referenced the ESSEC report, I believe it was 53, with their recommendations. Is there any plan for the ESSEC to make a comment on that, or is there any follow-up plan from the ESSEC on dotless domains? I was just curious about the path forward there.
At the moment, we in ESSEC, we have so much other things to do, so we do not have any plan to do anything more on dotless domains. The reasoning is the following. The applicant guidebook says that address records directly at the apex of a zone is not to be used unless, and then there is some wording about very special circumstances. So one thing we have to remember is that the applicant guidebook basically already says no. Then we were asked and had a look at dotless domains, and we made a stronger statement and said this is really bad. After that, the ICANN commissioned a study, which is not public, but if I understand correctly, it's close to be ready, which have been looking at the issue. And in parallel with that, as you say, the Internet Architecture Board had a look at it from a pure protocol standpoint by reading the RFCs and the fine print in them. And they also say, don't do this. So everyone that we in ESSAC, if I, of course, we have our like meeting in the group this afternoon, but I'm brave enough as the chair to say that we have a consent. We do believe in ESSAC that as long as all the formal reports that are coming out from various bodies say basically the same thing, there are different flavors of no, but they are very strong no's. We don't see any reason why we should, why we have to say something more.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Okay, I think we need to wrap this up. Thank you to everyone for the ESSAC for coming along, and we hope to hear from you again.
Thank you.
Just to let everybody know that tomorrow there is a workshop on DNSSEC, as we usually have on Wednesdays. It goes from 8:30 to 2:45, but in the morning, I think it's around 11 or so, there is a panel discussion to be led by Michaela here, it includes James Bladel and Vasily Dolmatov, that will talk about the DNSSEC obligations in the RAA. If you are interested in this topic, we urge you to attend. The information is online on the schedule, and you can come for just that portion of the program if you like. You don't have to be there for the whole day.
Maggie?
So next up, we have ICANN's compliance team. Okay, sorry, Maggie has changed jobs. She's now working for something else.
I'm just going to hand out happy faces at Walmart. Good morning, everyone. I really mean it when I say it. It's one of my fun forums coming here compared to some of the other forums we present at. So my name is Maggie Sirad, for the record, and with me from the compliance team today, I have Stacey Burnett, and in the audience, if you would raise your hands, I have Shauna Royston and Senor Victor Oppenheimer, and of course, many of the compliance team members are joining us remotely to hear and listen to the input from this team here. We have a very brief update for you, and the most of the time will be spent on your Q&A. Next slide, please.
Thank you, Maggie.
Yes. Next slide, please. Do you want me to come next to you and I can drive?
I can do it.
Okay. So year one audit program, as some of the participants may know, completed. And I am very pleased to let you know that the results are really coming out really well. We did have some remediation challenges, but we have overcome them. And we report 99% of all registrars who went through year one audit have really come clean. What I mean by clean is that the report is passed. And what that means, why is 99%? Because we had a couple of terminations that took place during that period, and we had a couple that remediated and will be pulled back into year two audit just to validate the remediation plan and the results. The report has been published on the ICANN website. Next slide, please. Year two preparation is underway, and the timeline will follow similar to year one. Scope is the same, and the process is the same. Next slide. Accomplishments since last time we met with you. We did finish the migration of all the fragmented tools, Excel sheets, emails, where we were capturing non-compliance challenges in emails and tracking. And the automation of the full compliance process is also completed, from prevention into enforcement. We've also added a pulse survey at the closure of a complaint. The pulse survey goes to both the contracted parties and the complaint or the reporter. It gives us an opportunity to hear back from both ways and opportunities to either improve the process, the communication, or certain areas that will probably need to be improved. We did add, before I talk about the multiple complaint submission, I wanted to, I think, Mohammed, I heard you earlier, you spoke about some of the language challenges. We did add the FAQs on the website, which is the Learn More, is in the six UN languages, and it's being rolled out slowly. If you go today to it, or if you join us tomorrow at this session, we're going to do a demo, and you'll see what it looks like. The multiple complaint submission is an opportunity for the reporter, and it was by request from the community to submit multiple complaints under the same user ID. So basically, there is a prompt that says, would you like to submit another one? We keep the information about the reporter. We just give them a fresh slide to where they can enter in the next complaint. As many of you know, we also launched a pilot bulk complaint submission. And I know it's a very sensitive topic for this audience, and we will have an opportunity for Q&A, but I want to assure you we're launching it slowly, very phased rollout, 3 pilot users, limited to 100 complaints a week, full automation and validation of complaints up front to avoid bad reports. This slide speaks to the validation up front. We had heard and had been working with many of you about bad reports. Pleased to let you know that if you can tell from this chart, before we even send out the first notice to the contracted parties, we're fielding out the bad reporters. And look at the number of closed reports that were done. Not necessarily all bad reports, but some of them were closed because it's not the right status or, you know, some missing data, missing information. But a lot of them are also because of bad reports. And the trend, I'm sorry, Sherry, if you can go back. The trend I would like to also share with you here, and you'll see it in some more in the dashboard. You see the turnaround time here. We start with a large volume, but we really are seeing a much cooperative and collaboration effort across all the registrars globally. We're able to collaborate and look at the number of complaints and how it gets reduced. We're really seeing a lot of first notice effort put forth and collaboration to address whatever non-compliance issue we're being faced with. The next few slides I'm going to leave with you, but I want to focus a little bit on this one just to share with you what we are capturing. I know it's a bit of an eye chart, but this slideshow will be made available to you. We are capturing internally and will be reporting on it, the turnaround time. This only reflects June because, like I said, we just consolidated all the tools into one. So going forward, we're going to be able to do an apple-to-apple comparison because it's the same tool capturing all complaint types, and every complaint is going through the same process. So now we're able to start reporting operationally. How are we tracking to the complaint types? How are we tracking to the turnaround times? And the turnaround times here are really, really good baseline that we're starting with. As you know, some of the complaint types require 15 for the first notice, then 5 and 5. When you see the numbers a little bit higher, it's a number only reflecting the collaboration, because sometimes some of the exchange of information requires additional information to be clarified or reviewed. So that number here is really just a reflection of how the process is working from first, second, to third to enforcement. And Jennifer, I don't need all those. I'm going to leave them with the team to look at. If you can just go to the next one more. Again, I already spoke briefly about the bulk quiz inaccuracy. This is just a recap. I would only like to restate to this audience that ICANN will, at the end of the 3-month pilot, collect feedback, lessons learned, input, summarize it, and we'll come back to this audience and to the reporters also that we're working with and assess how did it go, where are the opportunities or challenges, and what needs to be done next. So that's a commitment that we will have from us. Next slide, please. I'll leave that for the audience. I really left the slide here because we received a lot of good questions from you guys. But we also, when we did the outreach to discuss bulk, we shared with you what was and what is. Please, if nothing else, take a minute to look at the slide, because it shows you what how we've improved it and what's going to be and how it's going to be enforced. Next slide, please. Now I'm going to turn it to Stacey. As you know, and I think I heard James talk earlier about change management. Man, a lot of changes, guys. We are hopping. I feel like we're in a race between the policy changes, the 2013 RAA, the new GTLD. All of those are bringing changes also to contractual compliance. We have been reviewing, assessing, analyzing all those changes. We have three parallel tracks taking place within our department, led by different team members, to assess what are the changes and how they're going to be implemented operationally, and what is the impact, how we work with the registrars. So Stacey's going to provide you a brief update on those, but what I would like to remind each and every one of you, I hope you do look at the emails you receive from us. We do publish a monthly update. In addition to publishing the monthly update, we are pushing it. I don't believe in the push theory. Hopefully people are going to start doing pull. But we are pushing the email out to all the registrars. We push the monthly update through Mike Zupke to all the registrars, and every now and then in the monthly update, we add a registrar-specific addition that speaks to the operational changes. So we're trying to stay on top of this by communicating directly to you and holding outreach sessions to discuss those changes. So with that, Stacey.
Good afternoon, and thank you for this opportunity to share information about the expired registration recovery policy and the changes that are coming about as a result of the 2013 Registrar Accreditation Agreement. So let's start with the expired registration recovery policy. Next slide, please. Oh, I'm sorry. It was that slide. The policy becomes effective very soon, the 31st of August, 2013. So I hope that you are making changes to your processes and systems to comply with this policy. And if you don't understand something, we would like for you to reach out to us and ask questions so that you can make the appropriate changes to your processes and policies internally. Prior to the 31st of August, 2013. So, as stated in the policy, the purpose is to establish minimum communication requirements for registrars, to align registrant expectations concerning renewal and redemption of expiring domain names with registrar policies, and to make renewal and redemption of registrations uniformly available under certain circumstances. Next slide, please. So under the expired registration recovery policy, the registrar is required to give each registrant notice of their renewal and deletion policy. And this notice has to be on a registrar's web page. Next slide, please. So the expiring ERRP, that's how I'm going to describe it. The ERRP requires registrars to give two notices, which you're already required to give under the current RAA requirements. But the policy requires that you give these notices at specific times. So you have to give your first notice at least 1 month before the domain name expires, and then you have to give the second notice at least 1 week before the domain name expires. And this policy also requires if the domain name has not been renewed by the registrant or the domain name hasn't been deleted by the registrar, then you have to give a third notice. And that third notice has to give information regarding how the name can be renewed. And so that's a new provision. And in the policy, it clearly states, because I guess the people who participated in the policy development process determined there might be confusion regarding 1 month. Is that exactly 30 days? Is it 31 days? How is that going to be determined? And there's some flexibility in that time period. It can be between 26 and 35 days. And for the 1 week, it can be between 4 and 10 days prior to expiration of the domain name. And the policy doesn't limit registrars from sending additional notices. As long as you send those three we've talked about, but if you want to send 6 notices to your registrants saying, hey, please renew this name, you can do that. There's flexibility in that area. Let me make sure I'm going through all this. Okay, and so the policy also requires registrars to disrupt the DNS resolution path if they delete the domain name anytime after the expiration. So, for instance, if you delete a domain name 3 days after the domain name has expired, then the last 3 days of that before you finish the deletion, you have to interrupt the DNS resolution path so that the registrant has some clue that the domain name, there's a problem with it. And so if you, the requirement is the last 8 days prior to you deleting the domain name. You have a question?
I just wanted to point out, and sorry, this is James, and I don't mean to take you off track, but I wanted to point out that AGP is ad grace period. You mean the ARJP, it's ad auto-renew grace period, and that there's a big if in front of these requirements, that if you're deleting on expiration, none of this stuff applies.
If you're deleting at expiration. If you delete after expiration, that's when you have to interrupt the
DNS. If it goes
DNS.
Into the auto-renew grace period, but if you're deleting at expiration,
you don't have to do any of that.
Right. Okay.
That's correct.
So I just wanted to make sure for folks maybe you're seeing this for the first time, there's a big if qualifier in front of some of those requirements.
You're absolutely right.
Okay, thanks.
Sorry, is this the time you want questions? Because I have one about the first point.
Yes.
You said we had to send the first two notices no matter what, and the 5 days post-expiration we didn't have to send if they'd renewed. I'm assuming if they've already renewed before the first two, we don't have to send them as well, right?
So if they've already renewed before the first two, then there's no need to send renewal notices because they've already renewed.
Well, but the way these things auto-renew is we just do nothing and it auto-renews. So technically to the registry it hasn't renewed yet. So that's why I want to be clear that as long as the customer thinks they've renewed, we're good.
Have they paid?
Yes, but we haven't paid the registry yet.
Well, they think they've renewed.
Right, okay. So as long as the customer thinks they've renewed, we have no reason to sell.
That sounds compliant, but okay. We have to assess that situation. I don't want to tell you, yes, that's absolutely okay. Compliant. We'd have to assess that one, Rob.
But you do intend to pay for the renewal, Rob.
Well, it auto-renews. We do nothing, and it auto-renews. Yeah, so they don't charge us. The registry doesn't actually renew the domain.
Okay.
Yeah. So
we don't explicitly renew the domain 40 days ahead. We just mark it in their account and do nothing. But technically, the domain hasn't renewed yet.
So. Because you haven't paid the registry.
Correct.
We'd have to assess that one. Okay, so Maggie has just shared with me, Stacy, we can go a little faster. Why don't you just skip to the summary? So we're going to skip to the summary.
So that promised Michaela, Q&A.
So here's the summary. You're required to publish your renewal fees, your post-expiration renewal fees, your redemption fees, and you must make these fees available in the registration agreement, and it can be by way of a link. And you have to have these fees on your resellers' pages. If you have a reseller model, the information has to appear in your resellers' pages as well. We just talked about the communication requirements, two renewal notices prior to expiration, and one post-expiration if the domain name has not been renewed in 5 days or the name has not been deleted. And then the renewal process requires that registrars interrupt the DNS resolution path, which we discussed. And then also there's a required redemption grace period that all registries must offer. And during that period, if there's a request from the registrant to redeem the name, then the registry has to comply with that request if it's made through the registrar. So if you have questions, we put the link to the policy in our presentation. You can always contact us for specific questions, and we provide some more details in the presentation that you can look at your leisure. Next slide, please. Excuse me?
I'm sorry, yes, all the presentations from today's meeting will be published shortly.
For those of you who are members of the Registrar Stakeholder Group and want these presentations terribly urgently, we can circulate them to you via email, but bear in mind that some of the slide decks are quite big, so I wouldn't advise downloading them on your mobile device if you're roaming. If you do, you have been warned. But all of the presentations should be available on the Durban meeting site in the section associated with this session. And if and we can make that happen, I think, without too much difficulty.
And Michele, if I may add, immediately at the closure of the week of the ICANN meeting, on the compliance website, we publish all the material that we've shared with the community.
Okay, so now we're moving on to a summary concerning the 2013 RAA requirements. So, upon signing the agreement, or it's my understanding that we've had some registrars that signed the 2013 RAA a few days ago, or yesterday, was it? All the days are running together, sorry. And that registration agreement was made effective sometime in August. Right. So whatever effective date appears in your agreement that occurs before January 14th, I'm considering that like the signing date. But that's the date it becomes effective. These are the new requirements that you are obligated to comply with immediately upon effective date of your registrar accreditation agreement. And so one of the things that's really important that we've had issues with registrars with in the past, you must enter into an agreement with your resellers. And that becomes effective immediately. I hope that was clear. I'm going to say it again. Please enter into agreements with your resellers. Also, the registration data directory services specification, who is formatting, that becomes effective immediately. And so review that specification, and it shares with you exactly what you need to do to be compliant with the new formatting requirements. Also, the registrar accreditation agreement requires you to provide certain information to ICANN and publish certain information on your websites. And in conversations with our registrar relations team, there are efforts underway to make sure that you are able to go into our system and upload certain information that will be required. And I don't know when that's going to be rolled out, but it'll be available at some point soon.
Right. The bigger CRM needs to be put in place.
We're working on that. So until that is communicated to you, what you need to provide to ICANN and the method for providing it, you should feel okay. We're going to get back to you with information as to how you should send information that's required pursuant to the contract to ICANN. But immediately, you do have website requirements, and you're required to post your correspondence address. If the location of your address, of your registrar's principal place of business, is different from your correspondence address, then you have to provide details including that address, the phone number, fax number, and email address. You have to provide information regarding the names of your officers, the contact information for officers, and the position of each officer. Lastly, you have to provide the name of the ultimate parent entity of the registrar, if that's applicable to your organizational structure. Also, one of the important immediate requirements is that registrars must provide notice to ICANN in 7 days of bankruptcy, convictions, and security breaches. And then
Sorry, Stacey, just 1 second.
Sure.
Convictions
of officers.
Okay, yeah, but I was just thinking, can
registrar.
You convict a company? Sorry, a company goes bankrupt. I can't see how to convict a company. Or can you?
You convict a company of criminal offenses.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And that's in the agreement, if it's a conviction of the registrar, meaning the entity, or its officers. So it does distinguish that in the RAA. And then, so there are these additional reasons for registrar termination that you should be aware of. One important one is if a registrar has been found non-compliant, meaning you've received a breach letter three times in a 12-month period, that's terminable, even if you cure the breaches. So that's something you want to be aware of. Also, another important one, I might not have brought my notes, but I gave you the provision. You should look at section 5.5, and it lists a whole new set of, and it's also in our slide presentation, some of the previous slides, a whole new set of reasons why I can terminate your agreement. If a registrar is convicted of engaging in cyber squatting, found to have violated some law associated with cyber squatting, that's a reason to terminate the agreement, the registrar or its affiliates. So there are all these new reasons that you should examine and be aware of, and they're effective immediately or whenever the effective date is on your registrar accreditation agreement. And then CEO certifications. In the agreement, there's a requirement that the CEO certify that your registrar is in compliance with the agreement. And the CEO certifications are due to ICANN by the 20th of January. And we will be sending out something to you, meaning ICANN. I'm not sure which entity within ICANN, but we will be sending out something to you with a certification that you'll have to sign and get back to us. So all that's effective immediately. And then there are other provisions that are effective beginning the 1st of January, 2014. And some of these provisions include the abuse contact requirements. All registrars are required to have an abuse contact for the public to submit claims of alleged illegal activity concerning domain names that you manage. Also, a point of contact for law enforcement. You have to have an email address and a phone number for law enforcement to reach you, and this point of contact must be available 24 hours a day to deal with reports of domain name abuse or illegal activity by law enforcement. And registrars and resellers must provide a link to the registrant benefits and responsibilities document. And I think, I don't know if the name has changed, but this document that is referenced in the RAA, you have to provide that link. Again, that's not until January 1st, 2014. The WHOIS accuracy program specifications become effective in January of 2014. The data retention specifications, the DNS, SEC, IDN, and IPv6 requirements become effective in 2014, as well as the data directory services specification, meaning the WHOIS service level agreement requirements. And registrars and resellers must comply with the proxy and privacy registration program established by ICANN. And the provisions are in sections 3.1, 0.2, 0.4. So, again, please refer to our slide deck if you want more information, and feel free to call us or contact us via email if you have questions. We prefer that you ask questions as opposed to assume something and not be sure, and then we end up sending you first, second, and third notices, which I know you don't want. So reach out to us, and we'll try to help you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We have a few people in the queue, but before I go to the queue, I actually have one or two very quick questions for you. Are you guys going to be involved with the registrar outreach that we've been discussing with Mike Zupke and Cyrus? Because if you go back to through some of the last couple of slides, I mean, these are all new requirements that you will be policing.
The short answer, yes. But in addition to the outreach, as I stated earlier, we will be providing you on a monthly update, emails, what are some of the changes and how what's happening.
Okay, and the other one specifically to do with a couple of those things, is the how do you intend to police the law enforcement contact? I mean, I can see, okay,
publishing something that's visible to the public, say that my standard abuse contact, that's visible, but how are you going to know whether I've actually got a law enforcement abuse contact?
There's a requirement that you publish that information on your website for law enforcement to reach you. No, let me look at the agreement I have.
Not in the agreement. The agreement, there are two contacts for abuse. One is public, the other is private. So how are you going to police the private one?
Okay, so we'll have to figure that out, but we will, and we'll work with law enforcement to come up with a way that works for them as well. And we've had discussions with them about how we can work together to make sure that they are able to reach you and to contact us when they're not, because you're supposed to have this 24-hour thing, and you're supposed to have someone who's available to address those issues and take action. So we'll work with law enforcement.
Okay, in the queue, I have Jeff, I have James, I think, I have Mohammed, I have Bob, and I have the gentleman down there whose name I can't recall, but that's okay. If you come up to the table, you'll have a microphone.
And you've got a queue in the Adobe room too, Michaela.
I've got a queue in Adobe. So, Jeff, go ahead.
Thanks. Jeff Beckhouse here. So I just actually have a simple question going back to the bulk who is submission program. I don't think you need to go through the slides because it's a pretty general question. Actually, I've gotten a great deal of information through my interaction with your office, Maggie, so it's been very helpful. The one question I had is it's being referred to as a three-month pilot. Does that mean that the end of 3 months the bulk submission tool will close, you will evaluate the process, what happened, and then reopen it after, you know, an analysis? Or does it mean that it's going to go 3 months and then it'll just keep going after that and you will make those changes concurrently? Thanks.
Good question. The way we're looking at it is we're going to be monitoring it weekly also. If there is a reason where we need to really close it because of some major issues and assess it, we will consider that. But I don't have a yes, we'll close it or no at this moment. We have to see what is the reason to close it, if there is a reason for that.
Okay, no, because I'm just trying to figure out so then what are the next steps then after the 3 months? Just so the people here and myself, everyone understands, because 3 months, as you know, goes by very quickly. Is it the plan, if everything goes okay, it opens up further, what are those numbers, and how will we be involved in that feedback loop, knowing are there going to be, you know, additional people allowed under the program, what the results have been? Maybe put it in there and I missed it, but is there going to be an update to, say, registrars or the community about how it's going, what's happening, and what the future plans are?
So, yes, there will be ongoing updates throughout the 3 months, Jeff. We will not wait till the end of the 3 months and come with an update. And as you know, I really don't know how much interest out there in the community and how many will sign up, but today we've reached out to the three areas, and we will be providing and assessing weekly internally, and we hope that with the registrars, if you are experiencing something, you let us know. Not hope. I know you will let us know. But we will be providing an update on a monthly basis, in the monthly update, a high level. And if there's a need to do a reach out internally with you guys, let me know.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I mean, there was one point that really I was curious to know how compliance is going to try to work with, is when we talk about DSLS. I imagine that on your compliance, you ask that you need to have an agreement between the registrar and the resellers, and I'm curious to know what type of agreement you're talking about. Is that a specific contract that you recommend to have? Because it's just an alien that I have in my network, and somebody that can be an end user, it can be an entity, it can be anything. And to be honest, I understand that ICANN was trying to understand what's going beyond the registrar in its own customer relationship and reseller network, but it is really tough to ask for having a proof of any type of agreement or any sort if you don't recommend specific type of agreement. And I don't think that that's something that you will be able to achieve very easily. And the only thing I can make is to be sure that when you are a reseller and you stick on the button saying that you agree on my term, that term, what going to be? So nobody told me what are my conditions for him. And I'm curious to know. And that's the only point that I really have as a strong reserve, because we try to extend responsibility beyond something that is not contractual, as we already have between us and ICANN.
So we don't require that you enter into a contract with your reseller based on a contract that we have set forth. You determine those terms, but if an entity is providing registrar services on your behalf, then it's important that you get a contract with that entity that requires that they follow the requirements of the RAA, because whatever they're doing, you'll be held responsible as the registrar. So you want to make sure you have a contract with them that requires that they follow the rules of the, or the requirements in the RAA. So at a minimum, you want to put some of the provisions that you're required to comply with in that agreement. We can't tell you what to put in the agreement. You can put all sorts of additional terms if you choose to, but there are certain things you should get them to agree to so that you won't find yourself in a compliance issue with ICANN. Is that helpful?
I understand what you want. The problem is unfilled. What's going to happen will be totally different from what you're trying exactly to do. I'm just going to give you an example. Somebody buy a domain name from a registrar and resell it in a package to somebody else. He's my customer. He's not a reseller. In your term, he's going to become a reseller. In the environment, he's a reseller. But for me, he's an end user. He's a customer. So this confusion really is on field. Nobody's going to prevent it to happen. And when the end user who buy the package from somebody will come and file a complaint, you will have a big, 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 big problem. Because for me, he is not a reseller. He's an end user.
So that's a comment that we will take into consideration. I don't have an answer for that issue here today, but that's something we'll have to consider going forward. Yeah. In addition, there's a definition of reseller in the new agreement. So if what you're describing doesn't fall under that definition, then maybe that's not traditionally a reseller.
Okay, I've got a question from Adobe, and I have the same question myself. If the ERRP requires registrars with resellers to ensure procedures and pricing listed on the reseller's website, how does compliance envision to ensure that the resellers are in compliance?
Often when we receive complaints about a failure to do XYZ, we'll check with the registrar. Sometimes the complainant will state, I purchased this from this company and it happens to be a reseller, and we find out through the whois who the actual registrar is. But if we find out there's a reseller in a situation and we know the name of the reseller, we'll check the reseller's site ourselves. That's not always available information, but when it is, we can easily check.
So to be more reactive than proactively monitoring, is that the case?
So every year we come up with an audit plan as to which provisions of the RAA will be audited. And I'm not certain if this provision will be on that list for 2014. If it's not, then we won't be doing active monitoring. It'll be more through complaints that we receive about registrar services or reseller services.
Okay, thank you. Elliot?
Two things. I have a comment and a question, and I hope you hear the comment as supporting you, although I fear you won't. You know, it really is sad to watch the amount of effort that is going, that you guys are putting in around the bulk who is, where we have really effectively one squeaky wheel in the whole industry who turns your department so on its ear that you have to provide weekly reports and monthly reports and summaries and white papers and design systems to accommodate one person. And you know, I'm going to say to you guys something I've said to you before, because when I bring these things to you, both privately and publicly, what you say is, hey, this is what we're being told to do. If you need to push back internally inside of your organization, we can support you. But we can't lead that. We can't make that happen. That's got to be you guys who do that. So you've got to be the ones who first say, you know what, this is ridiculous and a waste of our time. We're not solving any real problems, and we have real problems that we're not getting to. It's you guys who have to be the ones to push back. And please come to us to help you do that. So that's my comment. My question is really a follow-up on Mohammed's, and welcome. That is so great to hear you contributing on this issue. So you know, I'm so happy to see you kick this one off. You know, we're going to need help at a definitional level. I look at this, and I've now read this definition, I don't know, a dozen times, and then I read the definition of registrar services a dozen times. It still looks to me like a web designer who has clients, registers the domain names in their own name for the clients as a bundle of services, is an end user, not a reseller. And in fact, what this agreement is now doing is encouraging me and Mohammed and Jeff and others to define our services in a way that makes it harder for entrepreneurs to provide end users what they want, and it's going to increase your complaints. Because what it's going to encourage is more resellers or people who are really providing the range of services to end users to put services in their own names or to use privacy services. So, you know, the question is, I mean, you know, as I described a web designer in a typical relationship that happens across tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of entities, you know, providing millions of domain names, they put the registration in their own name. They're not a reseller, is that correct? And please don't just say read the agreement.
It sounds like they're a registrant in that case because they're registering the domain names. But you know what, Elliot? I would like to see an actual case. I don't want to, on the fly, try to analyze this, and we could throw in a whole bunch of different what-ifs and facts. And so it sounds like that's a registrant, but
That's great. So if you say you'd like to see an actual case, what I'd like to do is to very proactively, you know, what we'd like to do, I say what I'd like to do, and of course poor Adam will be the one who has to do the work, but, you know, we'd like to proactively go through the fact sets and understand what is and what isn't so that we know, A, what's in breach and what's not, and B, how to define and create our services. And I'll tell you, you know, now is the time, because we are all of us, all in this room, going to have to bake a dozen new things into our platforms. And it is so expensive, so expensive. And I don't mean, you know, it's not just money. It's money, time, it's implementation. It's the number of complaints you're going to get. Right? Let's do this right the first time. So, you know, I hear you saying that's great. Let's proactively design this. And then, you know, that's what we'll do. But, you know, I fear that this construct, even as we proactively design it, is going to now create a system that's going to cause you way more complaints from end users about my reseller hijacked my name. And, you know, we're going to say, hey, that's an end user. You know, your problem. You're going to push more people outside of our control where, you know, Paul in our compliance department can't help you anymore than in. So, you know, congratulations to John in the legal department for, you know, maybe making some people politically happy, but, you know, this is going to be a problem for end users and for entrepreneurs.
So, if I may, Michele, just I want to thank you for your comments. You know, I do respect each and every comment we receive here. One clarification on the bulk. What we did is made sure the design fits with the existing process and tools. The only difference is upfront loading, and I do receive your feedback about your concern. And I know I hear that from every stakeholder group we visit. Let us help you. guys, you're up front before we even come into the picture about certain things. If you are unhappy with things, communicate it. Now,
wait, but with bulk, we've communicated that right. At the beginning, in the middle, at the end. What we cannot do, Maggie, I can't go to Fadi and say, Fadi, Maggie doesn't like this. You know, Maggie thinks this is going to, you know, this is going to cause her inefficiencies. She thinks this is going to stop her from doing other good work. I can't put those words in your mouth. You've got to do that, and then I can support you.
So Maggie doesn't have an opinion about bulk. It's a service for compliance. Yes.
Really? So you think that that's in the grand scheme of things, look, your responsibility is to see, it's not just, you know, go through the letter of the contract. This is substance, not form. Right. Do you see your job as contract compliance, or do you see your job as helping to stop problems in the DNS?
So, let's.
I'd love an answer to that question, pointedly.
So my job is to ensure that the contractual obligations are being fulfilled.
Great. Who's responsible for seeing that there's. Who's at a strategy level responsible inside of the ICANN organization for seeing that the DNS is safer and better for end users?
I think it's everybody's responsibility.
No. I want one person, because when everybody's responsible, nobody's responsible.
So I don't have an answer for
you. Great. I'll ask Fadi that question.
Please. Then. So the other comment I wanted to make is, you heard Fadi announce Akram's role as the generic domain division. And you heard also Fadi say how we will be working very close with Cyrus's team. So this is the opportunity where that clarification and upfront identification of areas we can collaborate on and address. So in addition to what we normally do, we will be looking into that. So work through Mike Zupke and the team also if there are additional clarifications that need to be identified.
Thanks, Maggie. James?
Thanks. Hi, Maggie. Hi, Stacey. And I have a whole boatload of questions here, but I'm respectful to the fact that there's a long queue, so I'm just going to go to maybe some highlights, and then I'll just tear through them fairly quickly. With regard to Bulk, who is, and maybe this was touched on, but my understanding is that these users are submitting their identifications and affiliations to you, but you are not relaying that to the registrar as part of the affiliation, as part of the investigation request. Is that correct?
It is followed the same as any other complaint. We've asked them if they want to be identified, and based on that, we will share with you if they are or not.
So when you say that you want registrars to tell you if the system is being abused, you recognize that we don't know if these people are opting out of that disclosure, then we don't know if all of these are coming from one individual or one user, or if they're spread out over
time. We will know. And we will share. If they had said that there's a disclaimer there, we said, do you want to be identified? Just like when filing a complaint.
Okay.
We have captured that, and we can share that with you.
Okay. And in the Beijing meeting, I specifically asked if your terms would include a prohibition on any commercial use of the Bulk Whois submission tool, and I don't know if the terms have been published yet, but does it include that prohibition?
I don't have the terms memorized, but we've attached them at the end, so we can check into
it. Okay. And then very quickly, one of the things with regard to the new RAA, and then I'll drop back in the back of the queue or drop out or whatever, but with regard to the new RAA, one of the requests I'm getting both internally and externally, and I'm sure other registrars are getting it as well, is give me your top five benefits that a registrant, not the GAC, not law enforcement, not IP, but that a registrant will see under the new RAA. I'm having a really tough time coming up with those bullet points. Can you help me? Maybe this is Mike as well, you know, but the new RAA has a lot of goodies in there for a lot of folks with a lot of agendas, but they're saying, from a registrant, what is the registrant going to see as an immediate and intangible benefit to an end user from this new RAA that they're not going to get under the 2009 RAA? And I've said some nice little platitudes about raising the industry bar and consumer confidence in our, you know, products and things, but I'm being asked specifics, three bullet points, five bullet points, and I need some help with those, please.
I'd like to second that question as well. It'd be helpful.
So this is Mike, and I would like to propose maybe as we're kind of preparing the update to registrars that we're doing this, this would be a good thing for us to build into that, because I don't want to, you know, try and do it off the cuff here, but I think I'm happy to work with you on that and everyone.
Bob?
Yeah, thanks, Jen. This is Bob Mountain, Name Media. Had a question for Stacy. Could you just quickly elaborate on what you meant with the cyber squatter comment, like how you would define that? Because many registrars also own domains, have host portfolios, and are subject to UDRPs, which decisions aren't always logical. So I'm just interested in what your criteria is on that.
I'm sorry. As previously stated, the RAA states that one of the reasons that ICANN can proceed with either termination or suspension is if a registrar has been found to have violated a law related to cyber squatting. And if you look in section, I think it's 5.5, it states the requirement that I just spoke of. And so in situations like that, we would be looking for some type of court document, a court order that, or a court decision concerning a registrar that might have been involved in cyber squatting.
Right, so a UDRP then would not be considered cyber squatting? It would have to be a court, a litigated event, as opposed to a UDRP?
So the provision, and again, I encourage you to look at the section I'm referring to in 5.5, because it specifically states a court decision or, and I don't want to misquote it. I haven't memorized it, but please look at 5.5 because that's what we'll be following.
No, we have, and our attorney specifically asked me to ask this question just to get confirmation from ICANN. So.
Just one comment and question from the bridge around publishing the emails for law enforcement. The comment is, it's a very bad idea to publish emails intended for law enforcement on the website. Wouldn't that be subject to abuse from the public?
So I think I stand corrected on that. I don't think the requirement, but I want to look at the 2013 RAA again to see exactly what it says. I haven't memorized all of the provisions, but whatever the requirement is, if it doesn't say it has to be posted on the website, we're not going to require that. We would only require what's in the 2013 and RAA concerning a point of contact for law enforcement and other similar entities.
Good morning. It's working. My name is Arthur Zonenberg. I'm in part of a registrar who is a new prospective registrar signing up on the 2009 RAA. And we're doing our best to become compliant as soon as possible in all our systems, but we may not be fully on time on the 1st of January, but we'll do our best and talk with you and see what we can do to secure that. I noticed in the new RAA that we are obliged to give officer information. What do you mean with officers? Does it include our managers or just the CEOs, CFOs, COOs? And how do we prevent abuse by customers that want to talk directly to the officer that we don't want, or that have to go through a first line process first in order to determine whether their complaint is justified?
So there's no requirement that you have to provide a direct line to the president's office. It just has to be a communication tool for them to communicate with the president. Maybe the president's assistant reads it and determines how it should be handled. That's up to you. But there has to be contact information for the officers. It could be one email, and I don't know who mans that email or reads it, but you'll decide how to appropriately escalate matters that need to actually go to the president and matters that could possibly be handled by someone else. I don't know. So that's up to you to decide. There's no requirement about that in the RAA.
Clear.
And then in terms of officers, Who are the officers listed on your articles of incorporation? I mean, it's clearly officers. We're not asking for all the line managers and the secretaries and the assistants, but the officers of the company. So if I were you, I would interpret that literally, the officers.
No, we have an email address for the officers already, so that's fine. In that case, another question about the ERRP from the previous presentation that I didn't get to ask. What if we know a domain name is going to be deleted after 30 days from now, but the expiration date is next year? So do the ERRP and the EDDP apply if we get a request from our customer to delete a domain name directly or to delete a domain name 30 days from now? Are we under the EDDP and ERRP policies obligated to send emails?
So the expired registration recovery policy is concerning expiring domain names. If your registrant requests, please delete the name, and it's a year before the expiration, you don't have to send out a renewal notice or anything like that.
Okay, cool. And my final comment is that I fully subscribe to what Elliot, James, and the gentleman over there said about difference between resellers in contract and in name and resellers in practice. So in practice, you see a lot of mismatch between the contracted party and the domain name holder. And we're making a general provision in our general terms and conditions that applies to all our end users. In essence, we don't have resellers. We don't support resellers, but we allow all of our end users, and we do direct retail to end users, to submit a registration for somebody else. As long as they inform this other person of their obligations and rights under all the policies and agreements, I think it's fine. The only problem you have, it's not a huge problem, but the only problem you have is if there is an infighting between the contracted party and the domain name holder. So if the domain name holder complains to you directly and they have a dispute with the party we have a contract with, then we need to determine an honest system by which such a conflict can be resolved. Because right now, we refer to the registry, or we refer to ICANN as an authoritative body, and your compliance department, but it may not be fair in who gets the use of the domain name, because the contracted party we have is probably paying for it, but the end user might have more right to it, but is not paying for it. So who gets the domain name in the end? It's a really important thing not to approach from a compliance point of view, but more from a dispute point of view, because it's never going to happen. It's going to occur a few times, but then you need some way of treating the dispute, in my humble opinion.
So is that a comment? It sounded more like a comment as opposed to a question.
It's a comment and advice.
Okay.
Thank you.
Johoff? No? Elliot?
Yeah, I'm going to be very brief. I think that was great. You know, welcome. And I thought that was a great comment. And I think what Stacey and Maggie have said is not our problem, but we're here to enforce the contracts. Don't waste our time with this. So let's not. I think I would really encourage you, because that was well spoken. You're new to the community. It'll be so well heard in the public forum or in different parts of the open mic process. And I'd really encourage you to make that comment publicly, because it's so apt, and it's so, you know, everybody is so tired of hearing it from me that I personally would buy you a coffee for that. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Maggie and Stacey and the rest of the compliance team. I'm sure quite a few of us will... Oh, James, now what? You want another go again, do you? Go on, you're going
to solve the problem. I thought I was clear that I was going to go to the back of the queue, but... Yeah, then I got thrown off the queue. So,
you're going into
so there was a question
lunch.
Regarding the audit and the new RAA and the new policies that are going into effect. And I've been told repeatedly that the audit is frozen as of last year, so that the new RAA and the new policies will not be impacted. However, some of the new components of the RAA are a reduction or an elimination of obligations that are still contained in the 2013 audit. So my question is, if you audit us and you say, for example, you're no longer, your WHOIS service, port 43 WHOIS service for this thick registry is down, and I say no, because we signed a new RAA, we're no longer required to provide that, is that still a deficiency, or are we going to, I know it sounds like registrars are trying to have it both ways, and I think the answer is, yeah, okay, can we have it both ways?
So as we're preparing for year two audit, we had continuously said, you're correct, the scope is the same. But if there is something that needs to be addressed, I'll take it back to the team. We'll revisit and see what is the challenge in that change and what does it mean, and we'll communicate it.
Okay, thanks, everyone. Please try and get back here for 1 o'clock. Local for the ATRT session. Thanks, everyone, for compliance, and I'm sure several people will be more than happy to harass you later, Maggie, with other questions. Thanks.